You're listening to an Alalon Nedcast, The Roxburgh Journal, Episode 5.
This is The Roxburgh Journal, and in this week's journal, we have a conversation with Andrew Jones. Andrew, otherwise known as the tall, skinny Kiwi, can be found on his website, which is in the journal, so we invite you to take a look at that. What was interesting about this particular journal is that I was sitting in my office in Vancouver in a warm spring afternoon, and Andrew was actually in Montreal, about 3,500 miles away, and we had a conversation together across that distance using some of the newest technology in recording on our different computers. So we invite you into this conversation. Rather than being face-to-face, it tended to then become a fairly roaming conversation about missional church, the roots of the missional conversation back in some of the missional movements prior to the Second World War. Andrew, as you might know, lives in the Orkneys in Scotland, but has a very peripatetic ministry traveling all over the world. So this was the first part of a conversation which we were supposed to complete in London, England in late May. I arrived in London and after doing some work, was waiting for Andrew, and yet he himself was off to Germany to a set of meetings that he couldn't avoid. So we trust that in a future time, not far off, we'll be able to get face-to-face and complete these conversations together. We trust that you will enjoy this edit of the journal and the conversations between myself and Andrew. My sense is that the, quote, emergent conversations over there are somewhat different than the way they form themselves over here in North America. Is that right or not?
Yeah, in some ways it's a little different. They're hesitant to use the word emergent because it does have an American smell to it now, so they'll often have to distance themselves a little bit from certain groups. But then they... Johnny Baker was just talking about the emerging church coming out of the alt-worship movement but being more integrated with the Church of England and other groups. And they would be more likely to talk about mission-shaped than being missional, which is
right. The
same concept but different packaging.
Actually, I hope to see Johnny in London in mid-May, and I'm also going to be meeting with Graham Cray.
Oh, great. Yeah, they're great guys.
Around the same kinds of conversations because, yeah, they've picked up on this mission-shaped language through that book, which Cray he led a team writing it, didn't he?
That's right. He did. Yes.
How has that been received? It sounds like it's been received quite well over in the UK.
Yeah, very well. It was just written as a report originally. But, it became a book, and it was recommended reading for a lot of denominations and groups there, and now it's just part of the understanding. And it's a good word. Mission-shaped, it's a great word.
It actually is a very helpful word. One of the tensions over here is to try to figure out what do we do with the language of missional anymore, because Everybody's taking it over, and it stands for everything.
Right, and it's losing its power.
It's losing its power, however... The problem becomes that when it loses its power, then everything really defaults back to a sort of a 20th century evangelical notion of missions, which is about projects and doing things and a more hepped up kind of evangelism. And so the deeper theological issues that missional was addressing tend to get lost.
But it does seem like we're going full circle. Back to the 1940s when people were saying we should stop talking about missions and start talking about mission.
Correct. Certainly in North America, the 40s, well, even in Europe, was an incredibly generative period of people writing and speaking about a very different kind of church.
Yes.
My theory is that in America, at least, all of that conversation got lost after the Second World War, and particularly with the massive suburbanization that went on.
There was kind of a blip after 1952 and 53. But if you If you go back to the papers that were submitted at the International Missionary Conference in Villingen in 52, you'll see there's a letter submitted by the younger churches, and they were the ones suggesting that we drop the letter S off missions and start talking about missions. And it seemed that year they were struggling to find a word that would just capture the idea of participating with God in what he's already doing in his mission.
Right.
And weren't able to actually coin one. But the next year, through Karl Hartenstein coming up with Missio Dei, that actually captured the German understanding of Mission Gottes, and then all of a sudden, being Latin, I guess it became international and was adopted. And
I think part of the problem then, you had people like, I think it was Hockendijk and others,
yes,
in their Church for the World,
yes,
in which you almost lost any sense of the church in that. The church was...
That's right. The church was almost...
there, yeah, and wherever.
Yeah, Hockendijk was saying that the church was almost unnecessary, and then there
exactly.
was...
Exactly. Yeah.
Then there were folk who had to rise up and say, no, there is a part for us to play.
Exactly.
Did you know that Leslie Newbegin was in those meetings in Villingen?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. Although... Yeah. Although it wasn't really reflected in his writings until maybe the 1970s, when he, I think... Maybe it was like a little time bomb that clicked off a little later on.
I agree with you that certainly in the World Council, which, you know, itself came out of the mission societies, mm-hmm. there was amazingly generative theologizing going on about the nature of the church and the mission. The church as mission was coming back up onto the agenda in multiple kinds of ways. I started doing some research into this when I was teaching back in the late 90s and realized that we really have to go back into that period and re-understand it and bring forward some of the work it was doing. I think we also have to come to terms with why did all that get lost?
Yeah.
And I don't think it was just, in the Hockendijk views, kind of a theology that threw the church out. I think there were just profound sort of cultural shifts going on, particularly in Western Christianity, that just massively sidelined that very, very creative period of time. And how to recover that, I think, remains a deeply problematic question. How do we re-enter that imagination again?
Yeah, and it was certainly lost. And you know, I was a missionary in the 1980s, and even in my mission experience, I didn't really come across this kind of emphasis on the mission of God. I still had a very old-fashioned mindset. And
did you?
Yeah, and it wasn't really till the 1990s when I started cluing on to the Missio Dei and the understanding that it might have been, Chris Wright in London who said that God does not have a mission for the church. He has a church for his mission.
Did you come across this language and this way of thinking, mm-hmm. that began to frame you in the 90s?
Yeah, in the mid-90s. It was actually through the forming of Young Leaders. And I remember Mark Driscoll talking a lot about it and Leslie Newbegin. And so I started reading up, and that really began my journey into this. So I'm quite new to the equation, and your books were very helpful as well. Although, you know, the word mission all seemed to reappear in the English language through Francis DeBose's book, The God Who Sends, and Francis and I were working together in San Francisco for a period of time, although I still didn't really catch on to that language. Yeah, but it's a good word anyway, and it does carry that idea of God's mission.
As you began to get into that understanding, how did it shape you and your own thinking about what you were up to in the world?
In a way, it's kind of a relief to know that it's not completely up to us to innovate and to figure it out and to make a way forward.
Right.
But when it's up to God, when he's already doing something, then the responsibility is to discover that, to find what he's doing, and then go and bless his work. And so in a way, it's a relief. You know, it doesn't all come down to us. It's really up to him. And
right.
And it drives us to prayer, to relying on him, to trusting that the Holy Spirit's doing something ahead of us and is wooing us forward into it. And yeah, it takes a lot of pressure off, doesn't it?
It does. Can you say a little bit about your own move? You now live in the Hebrides, is that right?
Almost. I live in the Orkneys. I've been there for 2 years in Scotland.
Right. Can you say a little bit about what took you up there?
Yeah, well, we were living in London right before that.
Yeah.
And it was actually a little too expensive to rent. And so...
That's going real cheap, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So that was one reason. But we also wanted to be in a place where I had some heritage, which I do in Orkneys.
I see.
As a returned exile, we go back to the 1100s in that island. But also to think through what a new monastic form might look like in a place where there were Celtic monasteries. And what we've ended up doing, because as you know, my work is all over the world, working with emerging church movements, and it probably doesn't matter where we live too much, but out of the overflow of our living and involvement with the community there, where we're seeing the beginnings of a community that's acting like a monastery, but not necessarily looking like one.
Can you describe that a little bit, what that sort of, to use your language, a monastic community for you looks like at this point in time, where you live?
I'm hesitant to use the word monastic. I was using it more before we moved there. Now we're there. If I use it, there's an element of weirdness attached to it, and people have strong opinions of what a monastery would look like, which is probably nothing at all like what we're doing. In fact, it was the same with church. The churches we started didn't look anything at all like people would expect either. So I would say we are becoming a community of Christ followers living in downtown Stromness, somewhat of a dispersed community, and we're attempting to be a spiritual center in our town. And just as the Celtic monasteries were media centers teaching people to read and write, we have hopes and aspirations of becoming a new media resource for the community locally and globally. Helping people to start finding their voice on the internet through blogging, through putting up websites. We're also starting up small businesses to help us become financially self-sustainable. We are involved in crafts, and we're a place of hospitality where we're open to people to come and stay with us. We're setting up retreats for people to be there. And also a sending base to launch people into God's work around the world. So, in fact, it's pretty much most of the things that the monasteries used to do.
Yeah.
We're doing it, but without looking funny and weird at the same time.
And describe a little bit, when you say we, who are the we? Is that...
Well, primarily my family, and then we're hooking up with the believers in the community. There's been people that have moved into the area. We're getting houses that are all on the same street, which is the main street in the town, and we're hooking into existing churches and ministries, rather than setting up something in competition with what's going on.
So you would be living a rhythm of life, and in that you would be part of an existing church, or do you have your own sort of worship gathering?
No, we don't have a worship service once a week. We are, in this case, we're hooking up with a partnership with the local Baptist church that's about 2 or 3 years old. It doesn't. It's quite non-traditional. It doesn't have a paid minister, but just a group of elders. But they're excited about what God is doing as well, and so we're working together.
Yeah. So in a sense, you're actually living into the rhythm that the Celts did, which was a coming together and a going out.
That's right. And we also do the going out. So this month, I won't even be in Orkney at all, and my family's been on the road for 2 weeks with me, just traveling with me, with going to places where I'm teaching. And this summer, we'll probably spend 6 or 7 weeks on the road around Europe, from festival to festival, and living as a family on the road, but also opening that up to other young people to come and travel with us as part of our pilgrimage.
That's a lot of moving.
Yeah, it is. It is. One of my daughters learned to walk on the Camino de Santiago, and another one learned to walk while we were traveling from city to city in America, in our Winnebago, which we did for about 2 years. Yeah.
Yeah. It's what you would call a movable abbey.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, the monasteries in Orkney weren't year-round monasteries. They were generally summer monasteries, and they were the launching pads to bring Celtic missionaries up into Scandinavia, Iceland, Greenland, and probably Norway as well.
Oh, so they went over from there.
Yes. In fact, those monasteries are still there. You should come and see them sometime.
I'd love to come up there and see them.
Yeah, I'd love to show you.
You're listening to an Olaylon Netcast, the Roxburgh Journal.
An excerpt from Tall Skinny Kiwi, Andrew Jones's blog, September 27, 2004. A monastery in Orkney, our next step? I think I can share this one now. Some of you may have heard on the grapevine, but I have not come out and said it yet publicly. I should say it now and include you in our decision because I want you to continue to be part of our lives and ministry. We think the next step for us as a family is to move our base to Orkney Islands, northeast Scotland. Sounds outrageous? Wait, it is even more wacky than that. We think God wants us to start a monastery there, a pilgrimage center for young people to equip, send out, and guide them to where God is leading them. A place for prayer, reflection, research, arts, study, and new media resources for the new wave of young apostles and pilgrims. Some history. I could start with our urban monastery experiment in San Francisco called the Celtic House, but that was in 1997, and I will jump ahead for the sake of brevity. Number one, for the past few years, we had a quasi-monastic community in Prague that we called the Giant Peach. It was a good place, but many of the young people struggled with the language and were not able to make enough money to survive, so they usually left early to go back to the USA to make some money. We thought about shifting our monastery to the UK. Number two, prophetic people have prayed for us and told us what God was telling them. Wolfgang Simpson stayed in the Giant Peach and had a dream about us. God said to him, "Don't forget that Andrew is my abbot." He saw us in a large place with a lot of green grass and people, and that sounded right to us. Derek and Amy Chapman told us that we would leave Prague, go to somewhere restful for about 6 months, and then go to a place that we loved and would be a home to us. That pretty much sums up what is happening. Number three, summer of 2003, we traveled to the UK to look for an unused monastery or similar structure. We didn't find one. If I was smarter, I would have realized that monasteries in the UK have traditionally been located on the islands in the north, Iona, Holy Island, Orkney, etc. But hey, I was still in my 30s, and I should be forgiven for lack of insight. Number four, we moved to the UK in January 2004. No monastery yet, but we felt it was the right step. London was the best place to land. Number five, summer of 2004. We did a Celtic pilgrimage to the north of Scotland, checking out monasteries and pilgrimage sites. We were drawn to Orkney Islands and spent most of our time there and took lots of photos. Our first visit to Orkney was in 2000 with my mother. My mom's maiden name is Clouston, a name from Orkney Islands, going back 900 years, back to King Harald of Norway's son. Did you know that I'm royalty? We discovered some great family heritage. We also fell in love with Orkney Islands. Number six, we have been waiting to get more feedback from trusted friends. Feedback is all positive. Co-workers at Dawn felt it would be good to focus on North Atlantic countries. We have had one church and one organization say they might be able to help start the monastery. Some people in USA are considering coming up to join us. Number seven, this morning I came across some prophetic words about these islands, and I sense that we might be on the right track. I have included some of them below, and I would be happy to hear from others about what they hear from God on this. Number eight, I can't keep my wife in limbo anymore. I said that I would give a yes or no today, and I am saying yes, I think. We will probably leave London in October and move to a rented house in Stromness, Orkney Islands. From there, we will try to figure out what God wants us to do. Yes, I know that travel in and out will be difficult and time-consuming. Yes, people may forget us, but we feel it is what God wants, and our time is in His hand. Will I still be involved in church planting movements in the global emerging church? Absolutely, yes. I will still travel, and one-third of my time assisting countries to develop strategies and foster unity. Much of this is done online, and I will keep on traveling to be where the action is, but it will be great to have a strong spiritual base to work out of.
One of the reflections I've had, and it's not me alone, for example, I've just been reading a piece of theology by Graham Ward, who teaches at the University of Manchester, in which he's asking the question of how do cultures change, which really is a subset of Newbegin's question of what is a missional engagement with Western culture.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that's implicit in Ward's work is that cultures don't change primarily through elites, but they change through the practices of people. And I'm wondering what are the implications of that for the work that all of us are involved in, which is really asking the question of what is the shape and the identity of a church which is a mission-shaped church for the sake of the world, and what does it mean to have practices that shape its life? Mm-hmm. I'm wondering what kind of reflections you've done on that.
Yeah, well, I haven't read Graham Ward yet, but when you say that, it reminds me that much of our philosophy is an explanation of perhaps what's already happening. So there's always experience and there's always explanation, but in my opinion, experience often precedes explanation. Many of the philosophers are explaining what the artists were trying to say through their art, or perhaps what people on the ground have actually been doing and the rhythms and the practices that they come up with. So in regards to the emerging missional church, I see a lot of things going on that at this point aren't really explained. And
yeah,
it seems like there's a need for poets and prophets to create some vocabulary or some concepts that create meaning and understanding and help our new experiences to be translated back to the traditional church and submitted to the churches for accountability and to compare with what the early church did. And this is what I see going on right now. And it's great when that happens, when somebody can put into words what we're experiencing and what we're doing and what God is blessing. But that's not always the case. There's a lot of practices and things we're doing now. We just know instinctively that the Holy Spirit is in this and He's happy with it, and we see it reflected in the Scriptures, but there's not always a great way to explain what we're doing without creating offense or misunderstanding.
People increasingly find themselves in a place where they no longer have language to describe what they're experiencing.
Yes.
And when that's the case, it's very difficult for people to go anywhere because they're stuck.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore the beginning of any kind of transformation is really about dwelling among and being present with and listening to what I call the stories under the stories,
mm-hmm.
in order to find ways of giving language to that. But I think you're adding something here that's very rich. You're also saying, alongside of that, there are now multiple kinds of experiments that come out of intuitions, and those experiments are starting to describe experiences, but many of those experiences still don't have the language around them,
mm-hmm.
At this point in time.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a very helpful piece because, in a sense, until the multiple kinds of experiences that are going on, until we can begin to discern a language for what is actually happening, it's difficult to move this stuff any further.
It is, and sometimes language isn't always the best way to do that. Sometimes art really helps. You see a lot of different art forms now inside the emerging churches, and it is somewhat of a language to work with, to explain the essence of what God is doing.
Right. No, I agree with you. It's not simply sort of a two-sentence definition of something. It's much more how you use multiple forms of giving language. So art and music and all these sorts of things are required in this place.
Yes.
It seems to me that what is gradually beginning to happen here in North America, at least, is that sort of the rhetoric and the high levels of rejection of what some have called the institutional church and the organized church, that's beginning to abate as there is a sort of a more growing recognition that all of us, no matter what label we put on ourselves, are in this sort of in-between place where we are experimenting and trying to figure things out, and none of us really have the language yet for what it is that the Spirit might be doing.
Yeah, that's right. And sometimes what we create doesn't look like what we intended to create, or perhaps what our parents would recognize as church. And at the same time, there doesn't seem to be a problem with that. It's almost like on the internet, you know, is Amazon.com a bookstore or not? And I don't think they're asking that question. They just want to sell books, you know.
That's right.
And there are different forms of churches now through a combination of online relationships and sharing life in coffee shops and meeting in homes and praying together and going to the, you know, the galleries, that complex combination of that seems to form a church experience, but it doesn't look like church, and each one of those elements doesn't seem to say that it's church either, and it's quite hard to explain. I was talking to a young couple this morning who said that they don't go to church, but they are believers and they are sharing in the life of God's people, and as we were talking about it later on, I suggested to some others that for those of us who don't go to church, why don't we all get together, start sharing life, eating together, praying together, sharing our finances together, learning how to be the body of Christ, and let's not go to church together.
That's right. And then we become church. Now, yeah. let me pick up on that, because I think you're onto something there. And again, I would really cherish your perspectives on this. Let me tell you some stories. Very briefly, this past week, I met a pastor in his 40s who wanted to spend some time with me. He brought some friends along. And these people, as I sat with them in a restaurant this week, they're not critical, they're not negative, they're not looking for a fight, they don't have anger. But all of them were saying to me, "We don't go to church anymore." And this was not a giving up on their faith. In fact, quite the opposite. And then 2 days ago, I was emailing someone here on the North Shore who's doing some very creative stuff and said, "Tell me where you go to church." And he sends back and he says to me, "Well, in terms of church, we don't. Here's what we're doing." And I could go on and on and on and on and on and on with those sorts of stories. Bottom line being that it seems that we're in a space right now where there are huge numbers of Christians who long to find ways of being the people of God together, but can no longer engage that inside the churches that they know. What do you make of this kind of moment?
Yeah, I call them the other half of church, because I do believe, and researchers have come up with similar numbers, that in many of our Western countries, half of the believers go to church and the other half don't. And yet they believe that they are church they're trying to make or find creative ways of living the life of Christ in community in their localities. And yet they don't want to go to a worship service, and they're often treated like unbelievers by the traditional church that's
right.
Somehow drawn a line and have said that if you don't come to a worship service, you're not really part of the church.
Exactly.
In the same way that the Roman Catholic Church drew that line many years ago for people that they considered heretics, I think the Protestant Church has drawn a similar line.
And yet, at the same time, it seems that the Spirit of God is up to something out there in that other half.
It does. And I still think that the biblical admonition to not forsake the assembling of ourselves together still applies.
That's part of the issue. Now, I would say that in almost all of these people that I sit with and listen to, there is a deep desire to find a way of gathering together and of worshiping together. It's just that what they're experiencing, and I don't want to be critical here, I really, this is not my heart at all, that what they're experiencing somehow doesn't connect with that which they're hungering for. And these people are not what I would describe as kind of seekers or need-sensitive people. They're not people wandering around saying, "Let me find a church to meet my needs."
No,
that's
no.
Not what is going on at all.
No, and people are connecting, and they're eating together, and they're in each other's homes. And another thing is that they're turning up at festivals all around the world. The festivals are getting larger and there's getting more of them. And it seems like the more organic and simple and small and tiny the small communities become, the more they want a large event that's much bigger than themselves. So it seems the tiny and the huge are both playing their part. When you go to one of those festivals and there's all kinds of denominations and streams and some people that you don't feel comfortable with, then you do get a sense that this is perhaps a kind of assembling ourselves together that is pleasing to God, something that's beyond our comfort zone, but reflective of the wedding supper of the Lamb that we're all moving towards.
When you talk about festivals, because I think of a North American audience in some ways. Festivals are part of the warp and woof of English and European life. Mm-hmm. Can you say something of them and where you see that in North America?
Yes. Well, yeah, Europe has a lot of festivals, and we attend them regularly. Greenbelt and SWAT in Poland, and I was at Freakstock last year among 8,000 Jesus freaks in Germany. But in the States, I've been to Cornerstone Festival with 30,000 people in a tent, and there's just many festivals like that all over the country. Or sometimes we plug into existing festivals, like in Austin, we'll often be a part of the South by Southwest Festival. But the idea is that you're with each other for a long time, enough time to hang out and really get a sense of what God is doing among us and to share life. And it kind of reminds me of the Jewish nation and the Feast of Tabernacles and that role that yearly pilgrimage and yearly gathering had on that community. And that was something that Jesus was quite keen to be involved in too. He was always, wasn't he, in a hurry to get down to the feast?
Yes, he was, traveling towards the feast. That's very interesting. I'd like to go back a little bit to, in your community where you live, are there practices that shape that community at this point in time? Do you live by a rule of life, or how do you shape that?
Yeah, it's not as official as I've seen it in other communities. But then we've also just arrived, and we're trying to build some rhythms of life with the believers that live there as well. So we have patterns of eating, and there's certain set menus on various nights, and we're trying to infuse ordinary mealtimes and experiences with a deeper sense of the presence of Christ and his mission for us. We're learning a lot. We're trying to implement things that we think could fit into the Scottish subculture or a culture in general.
Where do you see similar sorts of things going on in some of the major cities where you go?
Well, in the States, I've spent time with a number of the young emerging communities there in Texas, California, and I've seen some of the ways in which they connect with each other. In fact, we've been involved in some before, and also in Europe. I'm excited about the Boiler Rooms for 24/7 as a new form of church, which involves living together and opening up the space for hospitality and being a center of prayer for the community. We'll be at Taze in the summer as a family, just learning from that community and seeing what that has to offer.
Hmm.
I've been to Northumbria community in England.
We've had contact with them.
Yeah, but at the same time, we want to do something that's contextual and it makes sense for our particular little tiny spot of Scotland, and that might look a lot different from other places as well.
Well, let me ask you about things that might look a lot different, and I keep coming back and referring to North America, and as you know, one of the central characteristics of North America is its suburbanization.
Mm-hmm.
And what I find fascinating is that if you read a lot of, whether it's missional or emergent stuff, there is a certain kind of valence given to, if you're going to be emergent and find God at work in these ways, then it's a city. Whereas the vast majority of the American population, for example, live in the suburbs.
Yes.
Which are, I suppose, in some kinds of theological imaginations, become sort of the deserts and the most godforsaken places in the world. So you don't get a whole lot of what I would call imagination going on around what might God be up to in terms of forming maybe not monastic communities, but these kinds of communities in the suburbs. Have you had any experience with that?
My experience, having spent 10 years in the States as a pastor and also as a missionary, is I've always ended up somehow in the cities, because that's where the struggles are and the poor,
right,
and some of the hurts that need healing. And it seems that when there's a new movement of God, it often hits those spaces first, where the kingdom of God is needed most. And in my experience, that's where the emerging church has risen up out of those areas,
correct,
of the subcultural, organic alternative areas of the various cities. And yet, more and more, those areas are becoming quite expensive to live in, and those subcultures have to actually move out into the suburbs because they can't afford the rent anymore.
Right. And of course, the other side of that, and this is anecdotal rather than research, is that if you look at those who have been forming in America, quote, the emerging church, they tend to come out of fairly conservative evangelical communities, mm-hmm. which are primarily suburban, and then move into city areas yeah. in order to form church. So I think part of what I'm wanting to explore is what might it look like if God was up to something like transforming the suburbs?
Yeah, it's a good question. It probably has something to do with family and maybe more, because I know one of the things about the suburbs is that people travel very long distances to go to their churches.
That's exactly right.
And there's really not a connection with the street or with the houses next door.
That's right.
As opposed to an urban center.
Yeah.
And yet I think there's a real place for connecting to people, you know, in very close proximity to us.
What would it look like if we formed patterns of life in our gatherings as church people in which we want one of the ways of life we would undertake in the suburbs is to basically say, this is our neighborhood and this is where we love God, this is where we will love God amongst these people.
Yeah.
I could imagine that would make a massive difference.
Oh, definitely. Yes.
Yeah.
And we would end up with houses being utilized as centers for hospitality and peace and reconciliation.
Exactly.
Yeah. And block parties and barbecues and...
Precisely. Yeah. I just have this kind of impish imagination that in North America, most people in the emergent missional side of things have given up on the suburbs. They see them as hopeless. And so my kind of impish imagination is, well, that's the very place where God's going to start doing some stuff.
Uh-huh.
So I'm just thinking out loud.
Yeah, perhaps you're right,
about
and perhaps I'm guilty of that as well.
No, it's certainly not trying to blame. I'm just trying to think out loud of again, how do you create a movement? And I don't mean that in any kind of modern pragmatic,
uh-huh.
we're going to do this way,
yeah.
but how do you begin to imagine transformation of Christian life in North America? And I don't think you can do it without talking about the suburbs.
No. Especially if the working poor can't afford to live in downtown areas anymore and actually are moving out to the suburbs, then that's probably where things are going to start to take place.
Precisely. See, where I live, the downtown, which is about 12 minutes away from my home, there's very few people can afford to live like that.
Yep.
Very few. And so down the valley, which is where the suburbs are, you're getting massive building and suburban growth. This is the place where the people are.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, these are working poor and middle class people basically holding on from one paycheck to the next. I'm saying to myself, boy, God's got to have an imagination for these people and what's going on here that's bigger than some of these other churches that are being built. But, that's another conversation.
Well, maybe it's part of the same conversation. And certainly in the suburbs, if church is really going to happen, then people are going to be in each other's lives and each other's homes and more than once a week.
Exactly.
And people will be sharing in each other's celebrations and grieving over each other's losses.
Yes.
And I don't think that's going to happen if people have to drive half an hour to get to each other's spaces just to do that. I think it's going to happen on the same street.
Yeah, I completely agree with you.
And I think there is a trend, isn't there, for larger churches to at least move to a cell format where some of that can happen inside homes.
Yes.
I know a lot of it's still quite centralized and there's a expectation that everybody turns up for the big event on Sunday, but it seems that we're going to start seeing a lot more house churches and local-based groups rise up. In fact, the last 10 years has really been thousands of them that have emerged out of nowhere.
Right.
In fact, I'll be in Denver in a week and a half's time to discuss this with some of the house church leaders. This is a Dawn-sponsored event for global house church leaders. And what they're saying is that in 1995 or 1996, when I had a house church in San Francisco, there were only a couple of hundred of them. But now there's thousands and perhaps tens of thousands of house churches all forming into various networks. I would guess most of them in the suburbs and suddenly discovering each other, realizing that a movement's taken place and it's just been off the radar.
So Dawn is really doing a lot of research then on the house church movements across North America?
Dawn, about 7 or 8 years ago, shifted their focus almost entirely to the movement of simple organic churches in North America. Being a somewhat pragmatic organization, they were asking the question, how can we disciple the whole nation? And they felt they should put all of their stock into a movement of ordinary people starting small churches in the homes that they have. And now that they're beginning to count up some of those results, and even they're amazed about what's happened in the last 10 years.
Hmm. Now, how would you assess, and I honestly don't know the answer to this question, so this is genuine, the missional conversation, a la Newbegin and others, and a movement like Dawn and what it's up to in what you've described in terms of house churches?
Well, historically, there's been somewhat of a conflict. If you read David Bosch's Transforming Mission and other documents from the World Council of Churches, there's often been conflict with very pragmatic evangelical groups that have often had an eye on numerical targets and church growth or church planting movements such as Dawn, that they would probably see as perhaps not being as interested in social justice as some of the other mission organizations. But
right.
At the same time, it's possible that the two are coming together around a missional understanding of what God is doing and participating with it, which takes us back to Missio Dei, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's the Missio Dei. Now, I have another sort of very concrete question. In the work I've been doing over the last several years, working with people in the missional movement, in the emergent movement, looking at a lot of church planting, and looking at new forms of training. There are all kinds of programs springing up. Martin Robinson's Tim would be an example of that, but in Australia and other places. And I've looked at all this stuff, one of the sort of tentative pieces I've come to is that none of this stuff can actually leverage real the diffusion of a movement without there being at the core some kind of an order. Now, I use that language very loosely. Mm-hmm. I don't have in my head a template to lay on people, but I have a deep sense of across a country and globally, some form of a missional order is what we need to be looking at and discerning what kind of formation it might have. And certainly in our travels back and forth across North America, whenever this conversation comes to the surface, the hunger and the interest of people is very high.
Mm-hmm.
And I think God is doing something there.
Yes. And so, it all sits well with me also. It sounds good,
yeah.
And it's also what we're moving towards.
So what we are, we being at Alelon, are looking at is that sometime in the fall and probably in October, to invite some folk together to really talk together about what it might look like to form a missional order here in North America. And again, we're not coming to that with a document or a template all laid out. We're coming to it with some sense of what God might be saying. And so what we've talked about would be whether you would be interested and available in joining with us for those conversations.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at also inviting Dallas Willard to come and be a part of that.
Wow.
And so the idea is to gather for 2.5-3 days, a group of people across North America to have a very focused, intentional conversation around how might we begin to initiate a missional order, what might a rule of life look like, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. And I think what we're looking at is something like what Northumbria is up to, where while they have a mother house and a rule of life, it's a much more dispersed way of life mm-hmm. in local communities and contexts.
Yeah, I like that. And I've been thinking along the same lines. You know, I'm also connected to CMS, Church Mission Society, and they are in the process of moving from a mission organization to a movement of mission with some kind of a order of mission, with rhythms and some of the things that you're talking about. So they're also, I think, going in a similar direction. And as far as training goes, we've been meeting together as a group of Americans, Brits, and Germans to discuss the idea of a training trail. What would it look like if these homes and these quasi-monasteries were to hook up together and not only open up for young people to come for a month or 2 months of training and ministry, but actually start recommending that we go from one place to another to get certain things to complete people's training for mission.
Now, let me ask, when you say we are hooking up, who is the we?
There's a number of communities, and through the Boaz Project, we're connected to believers in Austin, Texas, who are thinking through this, and others in Germany, in Karlsruhe, and folk in London and Telford, who are setting up communities, and then just through the various contacts and networks that we have, actually kind of prescribe a kind of pilgrimage that would involve young people moving between the houses, involving in mission and also training while they were there. California also.
This really goes to the heart of some of the things that we're doing through Alelon. I mean, I would wonder, how might we be able to connect with some of those conversations? We would love to listen in and be a part of those conversations, because I don't think we have any desire to, well, we have a desire to join with what God is doing and partner with what God is doing. Mm-hmm. We are working with Martin Robinson in some of the forms that he's developing through TIM.
Yeah.
But would love to be able to be in conversation with you folk if you think there's a place for that.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, listen, Andrew, this has been delightful. I just wish I was in Montreal able to sit with you, because this conversation could go on forever.
Okay, it's been great chatting to you.
The Roxburgh Journal is an Alelon Netcast. Executive producer, Mark Priddy. Written and produced by Alan Roxburgh. Line producer, Sarah Jane Walker. Edited and mixed by Bill Kinnon. Original music, Substance Over Style. Webmaster, Brian Martini. Thanks for listening.